This is a More Than Just Podcast production.
So hey everybody, welcome to episode 380 of the More Than Just Code podcast. My name is Tim Mitra. I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined by Charlie Chapman in St. Louis, Missouri.
Hello, hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, thanks for coming. So I just wanted the one thing I've always sort of, I'm fascinated by your name because you go by Charlie, right? And I think, are you not a typo away from Charlie Chaplin?
No, Chaplin. Yeah. It's if you change the M-A to L-I at the end there, it would be Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah, so I don't know if you remember, there was an Eddie Murphy movie where he ran for senator, and he had a similar name to a senator who had just passed away. And so his platform was the name you know, and it was just, he changed his name to match the guy who just
it's
died.
It's like the Kennedy playbook. If you get the last name Kennedy, you just go on that.
Yeah, because then people associate you. So whenever I see your name, Charlie, and it's funny because it has a familiar feeling to me because I've been a Chaplin fan forever, right?
And it also has the alliteration thing that both start with the ch sound. And
right.
It's a very easily memorable name. I'm horrible at remembering people's names.
Sure.
But even people who are bad at remembering names often remember my name a little easier, especially if they hear it with the last name. And so I always feel bad because, more people remember my name than I remember theirs often.
So how did you get to be Charlie? Is that just something people called you throughout your whole life? Or I assume you're Charles, right?
Yeah. It's Charles. My grandpa is Charles Chapman. My dad's Charles Chapman.
And then cool.
I'm Charles Chapman. But my middle name is actually different. My middle name is Michael. And my mom was thinking we would call him Michael. And apparently it didn't stick past
a couple of hours,
half a day in the hospital. Everybody just called me Charlie. But yeah, it's weird because my dad was a junior, but I was not a third. And all of us live in the same general area. So if we went to the same, barbershop or whatever, and they look up your name in the computer, they'd be like, oh, you're junior. I'm like, no, that one's not me. And they're like, what? There were some funny moments because of that.
So why haven't you embraced the third? Why not the third?
Well, because I'm not technically, because my middle name's different.
Oh, is that the rule?
Same middle initial. So it's very confusing.
Mm. Yeah, it's like my stepsons, they all have a P middle name, right? So they all have three letters in their name, and P is the second, or the middle name. So yeah, it's kind of cool. And including their father has the same name too. Or middle name, not same, has the same initial.
George Foreman. Is it George Foreman that weren't all of his kids named George Foreman? Or is that is that one of those
I don't know.
Things that kids tell each other and it's not true at all. I don't actually know.
Yeah. So are you from St. Louis, Missouri? Is that where you kind of,
yes. I grew up here.
Yeah. And so Missouri, I'm just trying to, I suck at American geography, but you're at the end of Mississippi?
We're right in the middle of America, basically, middle of the Mississippi. We're St. Louis is where the Missouri River, which runs out west, and the Mississippi converge, which is why the town exists, basically.
And there's two of you. There's Minneapolis and St. Louis, aren't they? Am I getting that wrong? Or
Minneapolis is up north. You're thinking of it's the Twin Cities. It's St. Paul, I think, in Minneapolis, that's much farther up north.
Okay. So you're smack dab in the middle of the United States, continental.
Yeah. I've been doing all these conferences now. Yeah. So, you're traveling to different countries. And I always have to say, I'm from the States, and they get excited and they're like, oh, like LA. And it's like, no. Oh, like New York. No. And then it's like, I always say St. Louis and Missouri, because it's like a 50-50 chance. If they know who it is, they might know one of those two. And then I always say, it's that place you fly over on the way from LA to New York. And they're like, oh, okay. And then nobody ever asks any more questions.
Right. Well, I think we met in IRL in Beijing, actually, at the last Let's Vision OS conference. And I did ask you about St. Louis, and because I remember I think we talked about Mark Twain too, right? But I can't remember what the relationship is.
Yeah, because most people, if they've heard of it, it's it's because of the St. Louis Arch, the right. big, you know, arch building that we have, and or it's the St. Louis Cardinals, our baseball team, which is actually surprisingly known across the pond sometimes. But you're probably the first person that doesn't live in the Midwest that was like, Mark Twain? I was like, yeah. Not technically St. Louis. He was up a little bit north of St. Louis. But
he taught, he wrote about the Mississippi and all that stuff.
Exactly. He was on one of those boats, that tugboat things that was going up and down the Mississippi.
Cool. Yeah, and Mark Twain, for if you're not aware, is the measurement of how deep the water is on the side of the boat, I think, right? Isn't there like a mark on the side? There's like a scale on the side of a boat. Geez, I know something you don't know. Wow.
I don't know. That was his pen name, right? Samuel Clemens? Is that his real name? See, Samuel I should know Clemens, all this off the top of my head. But he was like a famous author. He did like Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer and a bunch of books about rednecks that live in Missouri, which feels about right.
Yeah, well, and interesting, and I think Huck Finn was one of the first who didn't see color, kind of thing. Was an interesting character.
Yeah,
little barefoot guy running around wreaking havoc.
Exactly.
Cool. So, and like, have you lived in any other parts of the U.S. or you always just worked out of St. Louis? Like,
no. I went to college in a different small town in Missouri, but other than that, I've lived in and around St. Louis my whole life.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, so we'll come back to your younger life a little bit here. But so currently, you're what do you call it? Developer relations at Revenue Cat, right?
Yes.
And and you're just coming up on a year, I think, on according to your LinkedIn. I don't know if that's
accurate. It'll be a year in May, I believe, which is like a couple of weeks from now.
So I am interested in the role of dev relations. I did something similar to that before it was even had a name, but you have been and are still an iOS engineer and a developer, like an indie developer, would you call yourself?
Yeah. I mean, I have an indie app. I don't know. It's weird. Like before Revenue Cat, I was always pretty strict about like my employer versus my like public persona, or what, I don't know what you want to call that, but like I never talked about who I worked for because I didn't want to represent the company I work for. I don't know, say anything bad. I don't know. I'm not a controversial person, but I was still extra careful. And so, but I make Dark Noise, the app that I have in the store, is just kind of my side project. But because of that barrier, a lot of people thought I was just full-time indie. I very much am not. And I always felt a little bad because I don't want to give people the impression that I'm like living full-time on this that is not where that business is at least not, you know, in its current state.
Yeah, that's a struggle. I do want to come back to working independently, but you were previously, you've worked, looking at your LinkedIn profile, you have worked in other companies as an engineer, as an iOS developer.
Yeah, I was at Stitch Fix was the company I was at before Revenue Cat, and I was an iOS engineer there.
What's their app?
It's a like it's kind of subscription box for clothing, basically.
Okay.
Yeah, they have like stylists. Subscription box isn't exactly accurate. It's almost more like a gig economy thing for a personal stylist, if you will. So you could like give it a whole bunch of information about yourself, and then literal stylists that work at the company would like pick out an outfit for you and send it to you in a box.
Cool. So let's go way back. So how did you get involved in iOS? Where was the beginning point, and what sparked your interest in this?
Yeah. So my degree from school was computer science, and then got a job in St. Louis, which in St. Louis generally means you're either on the Java stack or you're in Microsoft stack. And through mostly happenstance of my first job, I ended up in the Microsoft stack. So that was mostly what I did. It was like web development, enterprise software. I did have a brief stint building Windows Phone and Windows 8 software, which was like so much fun. Like, I just loved it. You get to care about the user experience. Touch-based interfaces are just so fun and like dynamic. You get to do math and actually make animations and stuff, which has always been my sort of side hobby, is making motion graphics and stuff. And so that was like incredibly fun and I loved it. But obviously that platform wasn't exactly long for this world. And so ended up back in the enterprise web development, backend systems world. And then at the company I was at before Stitch Fix, it was like a local kind of consulting company. I was building like a website and backend APIs for this company. And we had another team that was building a iPad app that consumed our API.
Okay.
And I was in a meeting with them and they brought up that they're like, we're shrinking the team because we have a less development we need to do. And then we're going to add a junior dev because things have slowed down. And so we can bring somebody on to kind of train them up or whatever.
Hmm.
And after that meeting, I sort of jokingly was like, how junior are you willing to take? Because I'd never written a line of Objective-C or Swift, never looked at Xcode in my life. But I loved mobile software development. I knew from, you know, my time with Windows Phone. I'd done a little bit of Android stuff on the side for fun. And they were like, would you be willing to come over? I was like, I mean, yeah, if you would take me. And they were willing to look past the fact that I didn't know anything about Apple development because I knew the system
mobile
architecture
super
well. Like I knew the 8 backend API super well because I've been on it for years at that point. And so I literally like went home. I think I was out of town that weekend. And so I downloaded Apple's like Swift book just to get a hint of Swift because I hadn't written a line of that before. And I
What year was this, by the way?
This would have been, it was December of 2018 because 2019 was when I joined that team. And so I like got through that just to understand let versus var and some of the weird differences there. And then I just got thrown in with this team. And that's why I started Dark Noise. I literally was like, I need to get productive fast. So what's a side project I can build on my own to kind of get up there? And I'm a dork who has a list of app ideas like many dorks do. So I just went through that list and found one that didn't need a back end. And that was a white noise generator because my wife uses that. And when we had switched to iOS from Android a couple years before that, that was one of the few apps that like we couldn't find a good option for. Like we liked the one we had on Android better than iOS. So I was like, okay, this doesn't need a backend. I can spend a bunch of time understanding like the UI and it'd be kind of fun. And then I can just try and get up to speed. And so that was kind of how I got into it, was working on it for fun at home and then coming into the office and asking everybody what the problem was and they would help me out. And then I'd work on my work stuff all day and then bring those learnings back to, you know, what I did in the evening. And it kind of created this virtuous cycle there.
Yeah, but dog fooding is a good, I mean, for novices listening to the show, wondering how we come up with app ideas. I mean, same with me, like way before iOS, you know, I would build apps that made my life easier, like something I was doing in my work or whatever, you know, maybe I was, you know, writing down information constantly, right? So I used to work as an IT manager. And so I wrote an app, basically a web interface, so I could store information and it didn't matter where I was in the building, I could just quickly pull it up and update the IP address of this machine and blah, blah, blah. And that ended up being an app that I created in Objective-C. And then, you know, over time, you know, I've moved it from pure code to storyboards. And now I'm talking about rewriting it with Swift Data and Swift UI, right? You got in just before Swift UI too, I guess that's the other thing. So have you ever done any Objective-C stuff or?
Yeah, well, so I can't specifically talk about the app that I was working on, but it had been around for a while. And so it had a lot of Objective-C, low level Objective-C, like C rendering of some text stuff, which was actually really cool. So I got to where I could read it. I could convert stuff from Objective-C over to Swift and like fix some bugs here and there. But I couldn't like write an app in it quickly anyway. Not that I'm quick about anything I write anyway, but it would be a lot less quick than anything else I know. But yeah, with Swift UI, you know, like it was really funny. I was doing, at the time, the UI stuff I was doing on the web was React. So doing a declarative language is kind of what I'd gotten used to with a couple different frameworks even before that. And so when I switched back to UIKit, it was like, whoa, this feels like going back in time. Mm-hmm. Like everything felt so manual. And it's funny, my wish list for the first dub after I started iOS development at the top was like some kind of declarative UI framework. Like that would be amazing. But in the time that I started doing it to the time the Swift UI came out, I came to love like how much you're allowed to control. Cause I'm used to the web where if you were doing stuff at a frame by frame level, you were doing something wrong and it's going to be really bad performing. And when I learned like you're allowed to write code that's like super specific at a frame by frame animation level, that I got to really love. And so I ended up really liking UIKit. And so in a few months, I got to the point where when Swift UI came out, I was the old cranky developer already who's like, I can't do the stuff I want to do in UIKit, you know what I mean, in here.
Right.
And so I do really like Swift UI, but I still have those two sort of competing voices in my head.
Yeah. Well, I have the Objective-C voice speaking where I could get away with stuff in Objective-C that I can't get away
yeah.
with.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like that. It's funny. I think because I didn't come in early enough, like I came in and Swift was already, it was mm-hmm. on Swift 3, I think. And so I missed
yeah,
all
you missed,
that
you missed the fun stuff. Yeah. Yeah. You missed the fun stuff.
Yeah. But like, I feel that way about like JavaScript. Like I can't stand TypeScript. Mm. I love how just free JavaScript is. Like that's okay. one of the things I love about it. And TypeScript, it's like everything feels locked down. You can't just do whatever you want. And I feel like every time people talk about Objective-C, I can feel that same feeling I have about pure JavaScript versus, you know, TypeScript mm-hmm. or something like that. Because Swift is like so opinionated and you have to do things a very particular way, which a lot of people like. And I guess I just got used to it because that's how I learned it in the first place.
Yeah, I had heard an engineer say at one of the WWDCs, I think maybe could have been 2019, 2020, that they had that Xcode is really good with Objective-C these days, right? So it's funny because I was trying to build something. I was trying to add, I think I might have been trying to add RevenueCat into an Objective-C app, but I wanted to do it with Swift UI, right? I wanted to use the new paywall thing, right? And I had an issue where I had to write a notification, and I thought, you know, I have Jordy's Mac GPT app on here. So I went in and said, hey, I want to write this notification to do this and this and this. And it just spit out the Objective-C for me. I'm like, oh, cool. Copy, paste, done, right? Like, but I probably could have worked it all out and kind of stuff. And occasionally I'll get stuck in an app which is the root is in Objective-C, and I'll get into a cycle where, okay, let me just try this in Objective-C and then remind myself how to do stuff. But it's a bit, feels like using a foreign language these days, right? Compared to, I mean,
yeah.
I told this story a couple of times before, but I had started writing a core data app with Swift UI up until about, I'd started it 3-4 years ago, and I'm actually just about to release it. That's how much progress I've made since January, right? But you know, I got to a point where it just didn't make sense between core data and Swift UI. And then, of course, Apple comes out with Swift Data, which is like a new sort of layer on top. It still is core data kind of stuff underneath, but so which means you can move from core data to Swift UI really easily, right? Or Swift Data really easily. But so that's kind of where I'm at right now. I don't know where my point was there, but somewhere in there is a point. I think the fact that, you know, like I'm loving Swift UI with it's so much easier to, like, the thing I liked about core data was at a certain point it feels like magic. You just do stuff and it works, right?
I think that's what made me feel icky about it.
I think a lot of people feel that way too, but because it's, you know, if you've done CRUD before, like you probably come from web, so you know create, reuse, update, delete, and all that. That's kind of a web convention, and it does all the CRUD for you, right? And literally takes the CRUD out of the work you have to do. And I'm using that literally, the way I say that, how it sounds. And then Swift Data is almost like another magic layer on top of it. And there's so many, it's interesting how many people are latching on to different approaches, even with Swift Data. Like it's you know, Mark Moykin's got one and Paul Hudson has another and Steve Lipton has a new one out. What's his name? Stuart Lynch, who's going to be at Deep Dish. He's got it. He did a whole thing on Swift Data. So it's kind of, I'm learning different tricks from different engineers about it, but yeah, it's cool. So let's go way back. I like to go back to the very beginning. Like, so what was your first sort of, like you went into computer science, obviously, but what was your early experience with computers in general? Was it like a computer came home from work or you played with gaming systems or how did you get interested in this?
Yeah. So my dad was a software developer. So he did like Lotus and WebSphere stuff. But I don't know that I had a computer at home, you know, we'd play games on it and do homework, you know, write papers or whatever on it. But I don't know that I necessarily got into computers necessarily that way. The first time I really remember getting into like the sort of programming side of computers was TI Basic. You know, we had our graphing calculators in school. And it, like the first thing is like you discovered you could write a little program that could make letters rain down like the Matrix.
Nice.
And then you kind of kept like, you built, like a lot of people would build games. I remember I would build like little apps. I wouldn't have called them apps, but now I would, that basically did my chemistry like calculations for me. Mm-hmm. Which there was never like, it's not like the teacher ever said you can't do this. And I wasn't writing, it wasn't like I was writing like cheat notes. But in hindsight, it's kind of like, well, that's kind of cheating, I guess. Like, because I could just plug in the three values and then it would spit out the answer for me. So I don't know if that was ethical or not, but that was, you know, that was kind of the first time I remember doing something that I think was like, it, I mean, essentially it was programming. I remember showing my dad something once and he was like, whoa, this is like what I do. And he showed me like what he was working on, had an if statement. And I was like, whoa, like that's the first time anything really kind of clicked there.
Oh, cool.
But my original idea for school was like, well, what I really wanted to do was get into animation or film somehow.
Right.
But to do that, you'd have to move. Well, you wouldn't have to, but if you want to do that successfully, you need to move out to like California or New York or somewhere.
Yeah, Nirvana, yeah.
And at that time, my dad got sick, and so I wanted to stay somewhere closer. And so then I thought I could maybe get into like marketing because that would be similar. And ended up picking out a college near us that had, they had a marketing program. I don't know if I would say it was an amazing one. I don't know how this all happened, but somehow the dean of the computer science program convinced me to switch to computer science. And obviously like that pretty much changed the trajectory of my life because it's a lot easier to find a computer science job, turns out, than marketing, at least right off the bat at that point. Cause I graduated in 2011. So right in the middle of the recession, it was not very easy to get a job. So that's how I kind of got into that. That's why this whole opportunity with Revenue Cat and doing this developer advocate thing ended up being a weird, perfect storm. Cause it brought my side hobbies of essentially marketing and all my software engineering career to that point, kind of mashed them together in this weird way.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It's been very, very fun.
Yeah, because I was going to say, like, you joined, like, right now the job market is horrible for engineers. But I think probably my theory is that everybody thought the pandemic was over and we can all go back to work and whatever that looks like, whether it's remote or hybrid or what have you. And I think that companies are misinterpreted the sort of signs, you know, they read the tea leaves wrong about how things are going because there's been a ton of layoffs. And it's interesting to hear that, you know, you kind of landed this job in the middle of a storm. So I guess it's a perfect storm for you, I guess, right?
I don't know. I'm not an economist. I have a like pseudo business degree and that's about the extent of it. But like I still think we're like computer or software engineering is still a very high demand job. I think there's a specific area that's been hit hard. And obviously there's the extra macroeconomic thing, which is the interest rates going up, making free money applicable anymore. But like, I still feel like we're generally in a better spot than a lot of other careers are. It's just that we were in such a ridiculously good spot, especially during the pandemic, where you couldn't, you know, throw a rock without hitting 10 job offers. It felt like during the sort of 2020 to 2022 era, that was insane.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting time. I mean, the thing about, you're right. I mean, I think it's an evergreen role if you're inclined towards development, whether you want to be indie or what have you. Like I'm finding, like I've been laid off since August, but I'm still busy doing things, you know, planning, putting lots of irons in the fire. And of course, so I've done, turned my energy towards my independent developing back again, like, you know, now, because don't have the day job anymore. Now I can focus on those pieces of software that I've been sort of, you know, what were my back burner hobbies kind of thing.
Right.
So that's interesting. So developer relations. So I spoke to the head of DevRel at GitHub a few months ago, and I've worked in a similar role back in the, I want to say 2000s, I guess. Before that, I guess 90s, late 90s, where I was basically like you. I was working for a technical company, and I was the guy who turned it into English, right? And then I also worked for Dev Relations for Apple for a bit, and that was my job, was taking the documentation that the engineers had written and turning it into something that, you know, it would go in the developer app, and then it kind of would cater to a wide variety of understandings in terms of technology versus, you know, learning how to do a new thing, right? But and that was a fun job. I really liked that. But what's a day in the life of a DevRel guy look like these days? I mean, you know, you're at a lot of conferences and stuff like that, but what's your day-to-day look like?
It's a very weird job. I think it's especially weird. I'm the first developer advocate at Revenue Cat, and so it wasn't like some established thing. And so like whenever I first got the job, I was like, what is this? What am I supposed to do? And so you're like reading everything you can, finding little books people wrote. And I feel like what I've gathered is the title is like, it's so radically different everywhere you go.
Yeah.
That there isn't this, like, this is what a dev advocate is. It encompasses, it's a very fluid type of position. And so I think in a lot of companies, especially bigger companies, it's like, okay, you have like your content people who are like turning out content, and then you have your conference people, and you have your, you know, whatever people. And like, for me, it was kind of like, what am I supposed to do? And the answer was find ways to make impact, go. Which was like very, very exciting because I'd been kind of on the pull the next ticket from Jira track for the last, you know, 10 years of my career.
Yeah.
And having a day where I sit and I'm like, I literally don't know what I'm supposed to do right now was very satisfying. It's scary at times, especially at the beginning, because you're like, am I doing a good job? I don't know. So what I've sort of landed into is obviously write blog posts and articles about ways you can use Revenue Cats technology. We're really big on like we want to be known as sort of the trusted source of expertise on in-app purchases for mobile businesses. So we also write a lot about things that don't use Revenue Cat, right? Like that's a big part of our job too. I think our most popular piece of content is how to write a store kit to, you know, in-app purchase implementation.
Yeah, raw, I actually just went through that recently in another app that I'm working on. And you're right. I was looking for, you know, I Googled StoreKit 2, blah, 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 blah. And your post came up and it's like the almost the second last paragraph says, by the way, you can add a hook in.
You can use us if you want to, too. Yeah,
you exactly. Don't have to. Yeah.
And it comes down to this, like, if we can be the best, which we think we are, then that's going to sort itself out because it's a pain doing it. Like we think we're providing a lot of value. So we might as well show you the right way to do it without us too. And then if you don't need to use us, like, you know, people like you doing consulting work, sometimes you just don't have a choice. It's not your option, but like, hopefully that builds some of that trust of like, hey, these people know what they're doing. Like, so if you're on a different project and you have the opportunity to use, you know, our stack that makes it easier and all these ways or adds a bunch of features in all these ways, then it's worth it. So yeah, so there's the content writing side. There's, like you mentioned earlier, the conference talk / working the booth at conferences, which is really like networking is kind of how I see those, which is something I was already trying to do a lot on my own. It's something I enjoy doing, and I was trying to get more involved in the community, and so that I've been loving. And then the other thing, which I think is maybe more unique with my version of this, is like I'm very much part of the marketing team. I'm very involved in product launches, and I really like making videos. I think I alluded to that earlier in this podcast already, but like, so when I came on and there was an opportunity to like, hey, we're launching this thing, can Charlie make a little video to talk about it? I'm like, yes, I'm going to pull out After Effects and we're going to like make the most punch above our weight version of a video that we can, just because it's something I'm passionate about. Mm-hmm. And at a smaller company like ours, I think they're really good about letting people, when somebody's passionate about something, it's like, let them run with that because then you can punch above your weight. We have engineers who will work on something for fun that maybe isn't the most ROI you could possibly get if you're just trying to make the most optimal feature or whatever. Mm-hmm. But because they're passionate about it, you're going to get something amazing that comes out of them.
Right. Right.
And so, I'm part of all these product launches and make lots of videos and stuff too.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, I was going to just interject there for a bit, but like one of the things I learned, I went as an early entrepreneur, you know, when you're working for yourself, you kind of think, I got to do everything, right? And if you're smart, you learn that you need to delegate some responsibilities to people who do things better than you, right? And I'm not really sort of like a, I like to have the information on how my things are performing or not performing or whatever, but I don't want to have to go and build a reporting thing. And Apple's, you know, in-app purchases stuff, it's pretty vague. I've always thought of it as a bit of a black box, right? And even just trying to get through reviews is sometimes a black box, as you may remember me telling you a couple of days ago. But I think what I hear, and this is not a Revenue Cat message, but what I hear from other people who go with Revenue Cat is they like the fact that they can get the statistics on how they're doing. You know, you go in there, you look at your daily graph or whatever, and you can get as granular or vague as you like. I mean, I look at it maybe once a week, right? I do have the tab open on my Mac, and every now and then I go, oh, look at that. I've got a subscriber. Yay. You know? So it's good that you guys are doing that kind of stuff. And again, like, rather than me having to build that, I think that's another reason why people go to Revenue Cat to get that done.
Yeah.
And I initially came over to you guys because of the paywall thing. You guys, when that went into beta, I'm like, yeah, I want to add this stuff, but I didn't know StoreKit enough. You know, it was Presto Changeo, and I had a paywall in my app, right? So
that was one of the first big features after I joined that I saw, like, from the beginning to the end.
Yeah, okay,
built
all the way through.
And like, that was one of those examples of like, if you can put a team of passionate people on something, mm-hmm. it's going to be a different level of output than you've experienced in your career so far.
right.
Like,
right.
that was such a fun project to be part of. It still is. Like, they're still doing some amazing stuff, but especially at the very beginning, it was like, wow, this place is different. But yeah, to your point about like the stats and everything, I think like kind of our whole positioning is the way we like charge is based on the revenue you come in. Like, mm-hmm. obviously we have the unique advantage of the whole point of using Revenue Cat is tracking your revenue. So we know what your revenue is. So we can charge based on the amount of revenue your app makes, which means if you're like a really small indie, we can either charge nothing, which is for the first however much a month, it's completely free, or it's a small amount, right? It grows as the company grows. But that means that we have to have features that sort of like scale all the way up so it continues to be worth it as you're bigger.
Sure, yeah.
And so like on the very front end of things, it's like the whole point is that it's super, super easy to use. It makes it easier to use than if you're doing raw StoreKit. So that's like, the regular SDK is a part of that. The paywall feature, that was a huge thing with the paywall feature, is like, look at how fast somebody can go from zero to I have a subscription app. And that makes, that brought a big part of that down, because now you don't even have to mess with the UI. But then as you layer up, it's like getting those stats and metrics that are way more accurate. Because if you've ever tried to build your own reports using Apple's APIs or Google's APIs, it is kind of a nightmare. And so we have a team of people dedicated to that and dealing with the changes every week whenever they come up. And so that's where we like scale up. And then of course there's a whole bunch of, you know, power user features, experiments and all that kind of stuff as you get to a bigger company that can continue to make it worth it. But because of our charging mechanism, we don't have to like gate those features. So the indie who just has this because it's like a college project or whatever, they also have access to literally all the same stuff. Which is kind of cool.
Yeah, it's nice. And for those of you who may be thinking about skipping Charlie's talks at conferences coming up, I saw his talk in Beijing. He was, unfortunately, I missed the beginning of it because I was answering questions after my talk. But I took a couple of your ideas and I've actually implemented them. So yeah.
Oh, nice.
That's my pitch to you. If you're curious about, are you doing a talk at Deep Dish or are you just going to?
Well, I'm actually doing a live podcast. My podcast. It's not Revenue Cat related at all.
Right.
I'm interviewing Sean Allen, the YouTuber. So yeah, that's what I'm doing there. But yeah, my boss is always, anytime I bring up a like talk idea, he's always like, just make sure it's not a Revenue Cat ad. Nobody wants to listen to a Revenue Cat ad. Like,
yeah,
he literally is like, make it valuable for the people that are there. Otherwise,
yeah,
it's pointless.
100%.
And so yeah, I always try to make a talk. I mean, it's not exactly what I would give a talk on if it were just me, right? Because I try to make them somewhat related to in-app purchases or money or something. But like the talk I gave in Amsterdam was about making a back-end driven like paywall UI, mm-hmm. but like that was like the excuse to make it somehow related to paywalls and revenue, but really it was like how to build a back-end driven UI framework for your app. And so yeah, I try to like make it something that's interesting hopefully to people and not just like use our stuff, you know, here's an ad, because yeah, people's eyes will glaze over and then you just wasted a bunch of people's time. Nobody wants that.
Yeah. You're waiting for the hook at the end of the talk. But so let's talk about Launch. Launch is the name of your podcast that you've been at it for roughly a year, I guess, or?
Well, I actually started that in 2020, January of 2020.
Right.
So it's been going for, I don't know how long, what is it, 2024? So 4 years,
yeah,
I guess?
4 years.
That seems
insane. Yeah. And so what's the gist of why would my listeners want to tune into your show?
maybe they wouldn't. I don't
Besides,
know.
He's an awesome guy. You know, yeah.
Yeah, and so it's an interview show. So basically, the premise is I'm interviewing other usually iOS indie app developers, but sometimes, you know, in other fields too. I'm interviewing them about the process of making something and releasing it. And yeah, normally it's iOS developers. And what it's kind of gradually turned into more because it's I find it interesting is like the first half is like the guest's history, what led them into the industry. I mean, similar to what we're doing here.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we go through either their apps or app and kind of the journey for how it got to where it is now and what the plan is for the future and any interesting tidbits that are interesting about running that, you know, business.
Yeah, totally would be interesting. So, but that leads me to which the elephant in the sort of room that we're both talking about is this guy, right?
Yeah, you, elephant's you have... a good name because it's very big and heavy.
Well, I think I solved it. I don't know if you can see the hat I'm wearing right now. I took the baseball bib off of the front of it because I was wearing a baseball hat backwards when I was wearing, and I find that it distributes the weight a bit better with the solo loop. And then
I
3D printed this top strap here, right? And my wife did the sewing for the Velcro and just happened to be rainbow colors. That was the fabric she had. But
that
yeah,
way this... you're not, you can still use the solo knit for the back, but then
like I can wear it for hours now without too much pressure on the front or top of my head or my cheekbones or whatever. So
yeah,
which is nice.
Yeah, I can definitely wear mine for quite a while. Like I can be in a call for a long time. My bigger problem is just like, I don't know why I would be in a call for, a call is the time whenever I would spend that much time. I don't know why I would keep it on. I feel like for me, it's an amazing machine for demoing the machine. That's the primary use case. And then the next one is like development work. But personally, I haven't found a way to like integrate it into my life necessarily.
So let's talk about that. Cause what are we, we're almost 4 months into having these things, right? February. Yeah. Beginning of February. Right. Where are you with yours? Do you use it like when you're using Xcode and stuff like that?
I don't really, to me, it's like a bad monitor that you can make really big.
Yeah.
This was kind of how I, now to be, you know, to be clear, this was my expectation going in as well. So, you know, maybe I'm just bringing in some preconceived biases here, but just based purely on the resolution that it can possibly offer, I knew it was going to be more or less like having a 48 inch TV as your monitor. It's like, it can be really big, but it's not like a good monitor.
But you went to the lab and we weren't able to sign into our Vision Pros when we were doing it, so we couldn't try the monitor thing. For me, the monitor thing is a nice to have. I mean, I have a puppy now, so I can sit at the kitchen and work, and I can put it on. You know, I can still interact with my wife. I can still monitor the puppy, and I have this big, you know, window where I can work in Xcode and have my simulators and all that stuff. And but I mean, for me, the come to Jesus moment was when I realized some of the, I mean, I've been doing 3D for my whole life, and to visually see the stuff I've created it floating in front of me as if it's real is, I think that is kind of the cool thing. But I'm actually interested in where people are going to work with this. I mean, that was part of the closing comments in my talk were, here are some actual practical applications. Like this weekend, I saw a surgeon doing shoulder surgery where he's got the visualization of the person's shoulder floating in front of him as he's working on the guy in front of him, which is kind of scary that he's using pass-through video for that. But
yeah,
but most of what they do in that kind of surgery, they're generally looking at a monitor of some type, and there's a cognitive disconnect. Yeah,
there's like surgeons are already doing things with grainy looking video footage. You know what I mean? Like, so that you can imagine that at least making sense. I'm giving the benefit of the doubt that, you know, they're doing the right amount of due diligence to make sure it's, you know, stable of an environment. I would be worried with this because it does feel kind of like a dev kit, right? I mean, that's kind of everybody's been talking about it. And so the idea of somebody using a V1.0 version of any software while doing a surgery on me is a bit terrifying. But in terms of, you got to spend time to build out this software somehow. And so I love the idea of people finding use cases for consumer grade hardware that can enable a bunch of, you know, new things.
that does. So the story is that we're all hearing is that this is going to be the version of hardware we're going to have for a couple of years now, right?
Yeah.
And so how does that make you feel, like, in terms of like buyer's remorse? Like, do you think that Vision OS 2.0 is going to be that much of a leap forward? Are they going to unlock some of the things that we don't have access to now in the SDK we might have in at WWDC? Where's the puck going with respect to WWDC and the Vision Pro as a product and the OS, Vision OS?
Great question. Like, I definitely don't have buyer's remorse, but I bought this with this. This has been my mindset the whole time. I wasn't excited about it as a, this is going to be something I imagine using regularly. It was more like, I'm going to build something for it because that'll be fun. It'll be fun to be part of a new platform on day one. I think based on the trends right now, I'll probably pay for itself within a year or a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
It's already like a quarter of the way there in terms of software I've built for it, but obviously it's slowed down a lot. But like the other thing is just having access to it early is valuable for understanding what they're building, maintaining relationships with other developers. Like, we're all figuring this stuff out together. That to me was where the value lay. I really was buying this as a dev kit.
Okay.
And so in those terms, it's like, yeah, this is worth it, because even if the ROI on this device doesn't come out positive, like other devices in the same vein or whatever, it's like the potential is there that's high enough. It's worth it to me. And it's going to come close enough to net neutral that I think it's worth it. So I don't have any like buyer's remorse for sure. If I was buying this for myself, not as an early adopter who just wanted to play with it, but like thinking this is going to be part of my everyday life, that's where it's like, I wouldn't have bought it because I don't know what I
would personally... So do you use it every day, I guess, is a question I have. Do you use it every day?
No. I mean, maybe frequently, but it's because I'm like, people text me to ask, am I being featured on the App Store right now? And I'll put it on. Like, it sits on my desk because I frequently put it on, but I'll put it on for 5 minutes. You know what I mean?
Okay, yeah.
I don't really like watching videos in it, I've found. But I have this big, nice 5K display right in front of me. It can't compete with that.
Right, right.
So, you know, I don't know. For me personally, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. The thing that frustrates me is the fact that the main thing I would probably use it for would be like some form of games or like VR experiences like the Quest. Because I have a Quest 2, and I would go through phases where I enjoyed playing games on it. It's like the idea of getting to play those in this much, much nicer hardware sounds amazing. And it's kind of frustrating that, like, I don't think even in June we're going to get, like, proper, the system is okay with you making a real VR experience. It doesn't want to be that, which is fine, but it's like, that does make it a little frustrating, I think, especially given that this is going to be the hardware we have for a couple of years, because it's hard for me to imagine a major change that unlocks a lot here.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that comments about that. One thing I do have a question though is I don't, because of my Apple, because I'm a Canadian using an American account, I don't have my Apple Arcade turned on. So have you tried any of the arcade stuff at all? Is there any?
Yeah, I have most of them downloaded.
But is it kind of like a blob floating in front of you in the volume that you kind of play with? Is it like...
Honestly, most of them are just iPad games that they added like a 3D frame around it. You know, like Alto's Odyssey is on there. Great game on the phone and on the iPad. It's essentially just
a flat
game like you're used to, but then there's some flourishes around
like
it,
the clouds,
right?
Same with like Cut the Rope. And...
right, exactly. But it's a bad way to experience that game. It's intended to be used with touch, and you can tell.
Sure.
And then the like Fruit Ninja is just bad for some reason. I don't know what the reason is. I think it's developer's fault, I assume. I really don't know the details there, but that one's not very good. The one that I think is interesting is the it's not on Apple Arcade. There is an Apple Arcade version that's kind of like it, but like the rhythm music games. There's Dap Tap, I think is the name of the one. They have another one that it isn't out yet, but they're like working on that. They were at that VisionOS conference and they showed some cool stuff there. Those are fun, but they're still like notably worse than what you can do on even the Quest 2 with controllers, right?
Really? Yeah.
It's just that the latency is not there, and it's not built for that, which is fine, but it's like, it makes it hard to like, what am I going to use this thing for if I can't play games or do any of that kind of stuff?
Yeah, it's kind of true, I guess. The second point I was going to make is like, looking at AR kit, looking at, you know, these objects, we can, oh, you can visualize what a can of Coke looks like on your desk if you want, if you open up a, you know, a VR object. But I can do that with a real can of Coke too, right? But, you know, I think there's still that sort of disconnect between what you can actually do. Because, I mean, the immersive stuff is amazing. I don't know if you saw, but I had a little 3D camera, really janky camera that I took with me to Beijing. And yeah. I walked the wall with it, right? And I had it just in front of me doing, like, the 360, 180 degree video, right? And when you put it on and you watch it on the Vision Pro, and I'm using that Moon Player app that one of the other people at the conference had, right?
Yeah.
And you can actually make it. And so you kind of get a sense of vertigo as you're walking along, as you're in my shoes, literally walking along, and I'm looking out over the wall and stuff like that. But the video quality is horrible because it's not. I don't know if it's...
That's the thing, right? Even the spatial videos that you record with your iPhone or with the Vision Pro, it's like maybe my eyes are the wrong, you know, interpupil distance or something, and that's why, or I don't know. But like the loss of frame rate, especially down to 30 frames a second, combined with the fact that both eyes have different levels of noise. Because of that, it's like a really off feeling thing. And I've found I prefer a much higher resolution, higher frame rate video, flat video, than the like spatial memory videos 99% of the time. But that's something you can imagine. I mean, it's going to get better over time.
Well, I have a friend, customer who has he's a photographer, so he's got the cameras, right? The cameras with the big price tags on them, and he got a lens, and he was going to shoot the eclipse with it, but of course the eclipse clouded over for us here. But so I'm going to be working with him a little bit, so stay tuned. We might have something kind of interesting coming out of that. But my experience was so bad with the camera, I sent it back to Amazon when I got home. But Yeah, cool.
Yeah, what I find is there's a lot of really interesting ideas and experiences. Even the like the can of Coke thing, seeing it in your space.
Yeah, you can do that with your phone. I mean, you know, like
right, exactly. Yeah, and like it's obviously worse with your phone. But the idea of when you're shopping for something, putting it in your environment and being like, oh, that is big enough, or oh, wow, that's not what I was thinking. That is genuinely really valuable. But so many of the nice experiences in VisionOS right now, to me, feel like, ooh, this is really cool if you're already in here. But there's not any of those like experiences that would pull me and make me want to use this regularly. I think the big use case, the one that the people I know who use it regularly, that seems to click, and it doesn't click for me, maybe it's my eyes or whatever, is essentially using it as a big monitor. Whether using Juno and you're watching YouTube videos, like a lot of people do that, or you're just like, you want to sit at your kitchen table and use it like a big monitor. Those two use cases, if that works for you, if it's comfortable enough and you're okay with it not being as nice of a screen, those seem to be like, I will actively choose to use this.
Well, I mean, the same way that when I got, I started because of the iPad developing for this platform, but in the same sense that I can take the iPad with me wherever I go, and I don't, like, you know, you have an iMac. If you buy an iMac, you're going to sit at a desk, right? If you buy a laptop, you're going to sit wherever, at a coffee shop, on the couch, whatever. An iPad, you can be sitting in an airplane. And I find that the Vision Pro gives me the flexibility of being portable. Like, I've got that chance that I can, doesn't matter what room I'm in. Like, the other day, I joined there's a Core Coffee meetup that we have that's run out of Vancouver, and I was walking the dogs, and I was coming home late. Yeah, Malin and Kai, and they'll be at the show too. But I came home late, and I just threw it on and joined the meeting while I made my lunch, you know, so I didn't have to like go and sit at my desk. Like, I'm sitting at a desk right now with a camera in front of me and lighting and all my props behind me. But, you know, this is not, like, when I'm on the Vision Pro, I'm just like, I can be anywhere in the house or in the backyard or whatever. You don't know where I am, right? Sort of thing. And from that point of view, that's a nice experience, right? I be honest with you, I do kind of use it. I think it's probably been like maybe 3 days when I didn't use it in the time I've had it. I couldn't use it on the plane. I found that because I didn't have Wi-Fi, it was so bad. But that 15-hour flight or whatever it was from Beijing. And plus I was in a little tiny, you know, sardine can of a desk.
Yeah, right? Nice.
So, huh?
I'm just kidding. I think mine ended up being like 30 hours of flight time.
Oh, yeah. It was 20. Well, I don't know if it was total.
Oh, combined. I see what you're saying.
Yeah. I did spend a few hours in the Hong Kong airport. But yeah, like I think the one stretch was 13. And on the way there was 15. On the way back was 13 to Hong Kong. But then, you know, 3 hour flight to Beijing, right? So,
yeah.
And ironically, you fly over Beijing to get to Hong Kong.
Oh, you went down and then back up. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Well, they booked it. I wasn't going to argue, right? But and it was interesting too. As just a side note here, that it's kind of funny because I'm watching the plane fly. It's flying straight up north of Canada along Lake Huron over in Inuktitut, I think it's called. And then it went straight over to Russia. I was on a Cathay Pacific plane, which is like Chinese, right? And I'm like, whoa, I'm in Russian airspace right now, and I'm heading down to Beijing. I'm like, whoa. And then I noticed when you flew over Alaska and around the Bering Strait or whatever it's called.
Well, yeah, my original flight path looked like it was going to go over Alaska and then over Russia and over North Korea. And I was like, whoa, that's kind of... And then it, like, as soon as it got over the Bering Strait, it just went down, and then it kind of flew along the coast. I was like, yeah. But I flew United, so it's an American airline. So that makes sense.
On the way back, though, that's the route we took. We went over Alaska and then across Canada, right, to come back home. But yeah, I just thought it was kind of funny that you know, I got to go to Russia. Wow.
Yeah, I was kind of hoping that I was going to get to. I thought it would be cool to see Russian land and North Korean land.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it was kind of, I think it was darker night or whatever, but yeah, I was watching the little interaction. Yeah, and then I also have, I have an analog deck here with, this mic here uses a regular XLR input, so I have an analog mixing station over there, and then I bounce it over to USB with a Behringer adapter, right, so...
Yeah, that's what I have, a Behringer. Behringer? I always said Behringer, but I don't actually know how you say it.
It's
audio interface.
Yeah.
It's funny, I was like, whenever I first got into this, I bought a bunch of stuff and I was super researching it. But once I got a setup that worked, I kind of just been locked in. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, same here. I mean, I do a kind of convoluted thing. Like I use the FXN to record my voice, but I'm listening to you and me through the monitor, right? So, because I always find that it's really weird when you're talking and you can't really hear yourself clearly, you know? So,
yeah, I should. Like, that's what I did for forever. But, the convenience of, like, what I found is when I go on other people's streams where they can see me, I like to use the AirPods because then I don't have headphones on. I just like the look of it or whatever. And so then I got used to it. And I think because I've done it enough, I kind of just trust my mouth position now. So I'm not as, which maybe is bad. I don't know. But also my, like, I'd use these. I've had these for like forever. I got them for free. I don't know, however long ago. And they just started kind of flaking out on me. And so I was using my AirPods Max wired in, but it wasn't my favorite.
Can you wire Max? I didn't know you could wire the AirPod Max in, the big ones.
Yeah, you buy the like flimsiest feeling cable that Apple makes. it's a lightning input. It's specific. You can't use it in any other context other than plugging it into the AirPods Max. But it gives you an eighth inch like headphone jack on one end, and then lightning on the other end, and it goes into your AirPods, and that lets you do input, which is nice on like airplanes and stuff. If you ever wanted to like wire in, although again, now I just use the AirFly with these because I don't want to carry even more big things than this giant face bucket.
Yeah, how do you find the latency with the AirPods?
So like it exists, but like I edit my shows, like podcasts and stuff, with my AirPods. So it's not bad enough that that's even an issue. It's not that I don't notice it. And maybe if I was playing like a hardcore game where that mattered or something, it would really bother me. But compared to my Bluetooth headphones, which sometimes I would try and edit with in the past, like pre-AirPods days, and I literally couldn't do it. But the convenience outweighs so much that it's totally worth it for me at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I have like I've been doing audio since university, right? So that's where I learned how to cut tape. Like I actually did it with splicing tape, magnetic tape back. So
have you done core audio with Apple APIs? Do you have experience with that?
Not quite. No.
Always on the hunt for somebody else who's in my you know, eighth level of hell trying to figure that stuff out, but I can never find anybody.
That's an interesting thing. So tell me, what is your experience with Core Audio? What do you, I mean, I've played around with it, obviously being with part of the Ray Wenderlich / Codico people. I've played around it from time to time, and I often think about it because I do a lot of music stuff, and I did for, I mean, when the Mac first started doing digital audio back in the 90s, I didn't play guitar for like 3 years because I just kept obsessing with these little 8-bit janky mixes. But so tell me about your experience with Core Audio. Where does that take you?
Well, my primary indie app that I make is called Dark Noise. It's an ambient noise app.
Okay.
And so that's why I live in the Core Audio APIs, is trying to figure out how to make endlessly looping sounds work. Oh, basically.
Nice. And are they synthesized? Like you're synthesizing these sounds? No.
No, that was, yeah, my original idea was that I would synthesize them, but then I realized like what I wanted was like a rain sound or thunderstorm, the sounds people want sense to be recordings.
Yeah.
But the what I learned is looping MP3s seamlessly is not easy, or not, maybe not possible. I'm not really entirely sure still, but if you want it to be a compressed, like audio file, you can do that with a CAF, but with an MP3, you're going to always have a little like moment of silence because of the way that, the actual samples are like chopped up. You end up with these like slight, I mean, very like tiny amounts of samples, but when you're listening, you hear a very noticeable, you know, sound.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. And I know people who would be annoyed by that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And a lot of my reviews specifically call out, finally, one that, you know, I don't hear the loop on, right? Yeah. So I spend a lot of time explicitly dealing with that. And there's kind of two ways to do it. One is like you build audio files that are perfectly seamless, but then you have to save those in a format that Apple's audio APIs will play without hearing the loop. So those are either like a wave or a CAF file, which is at least a little bit compressed, but it's still bigger than an MP3. And my sounds right now are baked into the app. And so that was kind of an issue. And then the other way is to actually like have two players kind of going at the same time. And as one fades out, you fade the other one in and you sit there and play with those curves until it's hopefully very imperceptible. And that has the advantage of, you can, which I still haven't built into the app yet, but I want to, you can then import anybody's sounds and you can loop those. They don't have to build them with an expertise. They could take a video file that they recorded of themselves in the woods or something and then throw it in there. And it would at least fade the beginning and end into each other. So
it's kind of the cigarette burn trick that they use in projecting film, because, you know, you have a reel that's going to end. There's a marker that tells you when to start the next projector. And then, and if you watch a movie where you see, like if you watch Fight Club, you know what a cigarette burn is, but you'll see like an anomaly in the corner or whatever. And then the scene will go to like an outdoor scene or something. Like it'll change perceptively, but that's because the next reel is clicked in, right? Sort of thing. That's a sort of Hollywood trick, right? But
those don't overlap though, do they? I've never actually ran film, so I don't know exactly how that works.
They can. I think there might be like a gate or something that somebody has to throw to switch from one projector to the next. But yeah,
that's interesting. So,
but I do know that, like, if you watch old movies, you'll see like a little in the top corner where it says click here to subscribe. No, you'll see like a little. It's literally, they used to use cigarettes to burn into the film to make a marker.
Yeah, it's like a circle, right?
Yeah. So. Yeah, and they really explain it well in Fight Club. So if nothing else, watch Fight Club just to learn about the inside baseball of making film. Yeah, no. Well, I mean, so, and for me, like, the thing is, like, I was going back to, like, cutting tape. Like, you literally had, like, an aluminum block, and you had your half-inch tape from one piece and half-inch tape from another, and you would slice on an angle, because the angle would give you that momentary overlap between one channel or one recording and the next, right? So,
oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. So now the analogy I use now in Logic and Final Cut Pro and all these tools is you have a blade, like, you know, it literally is the BT.
That's
tool.
What the tool is called, right?
Yeah. It's based on the idea of splicing two pieces of film. And actually, if you're watching this video, you'll notice that when I edit out the dead silences where Charlie and I are in deep thought and not saying anything, I'll splice that together. And then I do it's a kind of like a wipe, but it's just a merge where for a second there, you'll see somebody just kind of, you'll see two of us for a split second as we fade in and fade out.
Oh, you blend them?
Yeah. Crossfade, I think it's called. Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
But it's funny because, you know, if you're a Star Wars fan, you'll notice that George Lucas does a lot of those cross wipes. You know, he does like the...
Oh, yeah. He loves his cross wipes, his circle wipes.
You can do all that stuff in video, too. But I just go for the conventional crossfade. And at the end of the episode, it fades to black kind of thing, right? And I also fade in from... I do, like, a bunch of tricks. Like, because I'm editing as if it... I'm editing it for the audio podcast, believe it or not, right? But so start with the stinger where Mike, my voiceover guy, says, you know, this is our production, and then we do the little theme song, and then it'll fade in as I come in and say, hey everybody, welcome to episode whatever this is.
It's a little interactive.
Anyway, so I do have this sort of fun section of the show that I want to get to, which is where I kind of, even though we've talked a lot about you specifically, this is more about peeling back the layers, and it's based on the Marcel Proust questionnaire, and I throw in a few other fun questions. So if you're seated comfortably and you're ready for some rapid fire thought-provoking questions, we can dig in.
Let's do it.
All right. So, well, the first one is, what is your motto?
My motto?
What's the reason why people come to Charlie? Why do people come to Charlie?
Oh gosh, I don't know. I don't know why anybody would. I don't know why anybody listens to me at all. I don't know why. Yeah, that's a great question that I have no clue what the answer is.
So what's the sort of you get up in the morning and how do you approach your day? And
is keep the kids alive is step one.
That's a good motto.
And then have as much fun as you can is probably the next thing. Maybe I don't know.
That works. What's the best sandwich?
The best sandwich? Hot dog.
Hot dog?
I'm just kidding. I'm not even a big hot dog fan. I just like being controversial. The best sandwich? I don't know. I'm pretty agnostic. I like pesto. Something with pesto on it. Mm-hmm. Turkey, pesto, and cheese, I guess. Okay. I don't know.
What kind of bread?
I mean, I eat sandwiches.
Yeah.
Sandwiches are not something I get excited about, though, generally speaking.
Well, here's a random question that just came to my mind, and it's going to be controversial, and it might be an opinionated thing,
good.
But the deep dish Chicago style pizza, is it a pizza or is it a casserole?
Oh, it's pizza. But pizza is a, like, you know, it's a pretty high level classification of thing, right? So lots of things are pizza. I'm a firm believer in that. And being from St. Louis, it's not like any of our food is... of high protected status or anything. So I'm a believer that you can experiment with all sorts of genres of food, and that is great. And so I love Chicago style pizza. I love New York style pizza. I love Detroit style pizza. Mm. I love St. Louis style pizza, but I know a lot of people won't.
Explain to me I know what a Brooklyn pizza is, but what's a St. Louis style pizza look like?
St. Louis style is, okay, so it's a thin, like, cracker crust cut into squares.
Yeah. Choppy. Yeah. Okay. Gotcha.
And then the big thing is we have our own style of cheese called Provel. It's a blend of, like, provolone and mozzarella, obviously, and I forgot what the other one is. And then, like, there's some smoky flavor added somehow. That is the controversial bit. If you grew up on it, you like it. Most people, when they move here, think it's disgusting. And if you're here long enough, eventually you maybe relent and then you come to like it. But that's generally it. So most people do not like our pizza.
And, like, is there, it's like, a marinara sauce and then toppings and
stuff? Yeah, it's a thin amount of sauce and the cheese is on top. And the cheese goes over the toppings usually. So, like, if you have pepperoni, the cheese is, like, over the pepperoni, which is sort of weird. But it's the cheese is the real controversial bit. Also, like, the main chain that does it is not the most consistent. And so sometimes you end up with it. And because it's so thin, it's like, it feels like you're eating this, like, waxy cardboard thing.
Right.
Plasticky thing. Cause the cheese tastes weird. So yeah, it turns a lot of people off, but I love it.
Yeah. My wife likes that thin crust pizza. It's funny. I had a pizza once in Quebec, which was weird. It was almost like a pie, right? And there was, like, this much meat and then a little bit of cheese on top of it. So it was, like, thick, like a Chicago style pizza, but it was a lot of meat.
Mostly meat.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Really weird.
See, I like that. One of my favorites, my favorite St. Louis pizza place actually was not St. Louis style. It was, I think they called it San Francisco style, but it was kind of deep dish, but it was cornbread crust.
Okay, cool.
And it was, like, chunks of tomatoes, which I don't actually normally like big chunks of tomatoes and anything, but this pizza was just amazing. The combination of everything was very good.
Wow. Yeah. Cool. So who are your heroes in real life?
My heroes in real life, man, these really are, hard hitting questions. I have a hard time attributing, calling anybody a hero. Cause, like, the lesson of don't meet your heroes or don't, like, idolize anybody has very firmly rooted itself in me. So it's like anybody I think of, I'm like, well, except for that, you don't want to associate, you know what I mean? Like,
let me rephrase the question. Like, how do you, who in your life has had a really good influence on you in a sort of major mentorish kind of way? It could be mom, dad, teacher.
Yeah. Wife. I mean, my mom, like it's cliche, but I think the thing with my mom is like, she's one of the most, like empathetic people I've ever met. And that has deeply ingrained itself in me, to an annoying level for a lot of people, because like, I tend to assume, that people have a positive intent or whatever, you know, very few people, like just as much as I have a hard time defining a hero, I also have a hard time purely villainizing somebody, because, you know, because of that, I think. And so that's a big one, is just this like incredibly empathetic way of viewing the world, and assuming the best intent from most people. Like if I get cut off on the road, most of the time my gut reaction is like, ooh man, I wonder if they're having a bad day, you know, like that really? Is legitimately like my feeling.
Yeah.
Or
if
I have to slam on my brakes because somebody cuts me off, I'm more worried about the person behind me, like, oh, I hope they see me coming, you know, than I am mad at that person. So that's probably the, like, that's how I try to like model my life, I guess.
Okay, cool. So what's your favorite word?
Favorite word?
Yeah.
Trying to think of a word with good mouthfeel. I feel like random times words, you know, you just like saying them, but I can't think of anything off the top of my head now.
Let's twist the question then. So what words or phrases do you overuse? Like use too much?
I mean, like, you know, I've got enough of the California connection to overuse that one. I grew up like Southern Baptist, a specific like type of religion, and not that that's necessarily that relevant, but I didn't grow up cursing or being around people cussing very much. Right. I don't have like a personal moral problem with it. It's just not my default way of speaking. And I joined this company that was like, you know, one of those cool startup feeling, it was actually consulting, but you know, kind of companies. And they had all the conference rooms wired together with Xboxes so that you could play Halo over lunchtime. And so I would play Halo with everybody. They all had the headsets on, you know, whatever. And what I found is, an embarrassing thing about my vernacular in this moment, when you have a headset connected to you, is a normal person, but most of these people, whenever you're playing and you're getting in a gunfight or whatever, you'd start yelling, you know, I don't know if you can cuss on this podcast, but curse words, you know, you're like, you know, dang it, whatever. My default when I was in one of those modes would be like, daggummit, because I have this, my extended family's from Alabama. I grew up here, but so I have all these sort of Alabama like phrases that would come out, and I'm saying them into a microphone. So all these people who I'm meeting for the first time, that's what they're hearing. And they're like, oh my gosh, look at this, you know, redneck. and it's the same thing when I talk to my dog. If I'm trying to get my dog to do something, I go into full like bird dog training voice, which is very Alabama. So I'm on a sort of busy-ish corner where everybody walks in my neighborhood, and my dog would start barking, and I would open the door, not knowing he was barking at a person. I'd be like, you know, I'm here, you know, and I'd go full like Alabama, and then realize there's somebody on the sidewalk, and I'd be very embarrassed. Like, oh no, who do they think just moved into this neighborhood? so I guess it's not specific words, but more intonation, is the thing I overuse sometimes.
Hmm. What number am I thinking of?
7.
Oh, so close.
Ah, that would have been pretty sweet if I got it right.
Though,
right?
I was just thinking the same thing. Like, so one of the things I did in Vision Pro in the tutorial is I learned to use a particle emitter to like have confetti fly around you when you achieved a certain goal. But I'm trying to figure out how to work that into real life, right? Have you ever asked anybody for their autograph?
I do it.
Are you trying to do the...
Oh, it's not doing it. Why is it not doing it? Oh, that's balloons. Oh, balloons. Which one's confetti?
I don't know.
I guess nobody listening knows what I'm doing. I'm trying to do the hand signals to make
this one.
Apple's webcam thing automatically. Is it just one?
Yeah.
Nope, that one's balloons too. Did it not pick up both of them, I guess?
Oh, here comes my dog.
Maybe it's because they're out of... Oh, there we go. It is two. I was right.
Oh,
there.
I got two. Confetti. Okay, cool. Good job. I didn't know that.
I didn't hear what your next question was. I was too busy trying to
trick. Yeah, that's Apple. Okay. Have you ever asked anybody for their autograph?
Surely I have. Probably like baseball players, I'm sure. Well, I don't know.
Yeah.
I did sign an autograph. The first dub I went to,
yeah,
which was 2022, is the first one like back. Michael Flareup's app icon book.
Oh, cool. Yeah,
come
yeah.
out recently.
Yeah, yeah.
And my app, Dark Noise, is in there.
Oh, nice.
And so it was like we had one of those meetups where everybody gets together at Dub Dub, and somebody came up to me with the book and was like, can you sign this? And I was like, oh my gosh, I had somebody take a picture of me signing it so I could send my family and be like, people are asking me for autographs. We'll ignore the fact that it's like he was doing that to everybody. But yeah, so I've signed an autograph. I'm sure I've asked for an autograph before, but I can't.
Yeah,
I can't think of a moment.
I keep wondering if should I hand somebody my phone and get them to sign my phone.
Can, don't just connect
yeah,
the cables.
Yeah. Who would you want to sign your phone though? Who would that be?
I met Bill Atkinson at WWDC.
Oh, that'd be a good one.
So yeah, he signed my badge. Cool. I got him to sign my badge.
When was that? Like, what WWDC are we talking about? How long
I think
ago?
It was 2011 or 2010.
Okay.
Yeah, he had written a photo app and he was just sitting in the audience as a developer. It was at the Stump the Experts thing they used to do.
I'm embarrassed. I don't know that I would recognize him if I saw him.
Yeah, I don't think, because I mean, he's got the glasses and the curly hair and the face.
Is he still, my vision of him is like, okay, that's what I'm saying, yeah.
He kind of looks like me now, like it looks old, right? So, you wouldn't have known, but somebody in the audience pointed it out and I walked up and asked him to sign my badge and everybody looked at me like, who the hell are you asking to sign your badge? The guy who signed the box right behind me, that's who, you know, in case you didn't know who he was. I've met musicians, hockey players, you know, to various, various people. So, if you write a book and, I'll definitely get you to sign the book if I have the book in my hand.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I should have done that with, Mejd Tabby now that I think about it, cause I have his book and I met him, but I didn't bring it with me cause it's a big, you know, photo book. I feel like if I were to meet I haven't really met many like famous people either. Like the only environment where I would get somebody to sign something would be like, I'm at an event where like a baseball, you know, Cardinals baseball player is there to sign everybody's whatever. But this might surprise you, but living in St. Louis, Missouri, I don't come across celebrities very often.
Right, right.
Despite, you know, our well-known
Center of the United
States.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
So it's not a situation that I've really come up across, but I don't know that I would be brave and maybe not brave because I don't even know that I, in hindsight, would think I should, but I don't know that I would ever go up to somebody to talk to them.
Yeah. I mean, the few times I've run into famous people, I'll say, hey, I love your work. It's funny, in Canada, we have a lot of people who come up here to shoot movies and stuff. And we're generally pretty respectful. If we see you in the grocery store, we don't really come up to you and, you know, like it's not like the Hollywood thing where people are constantly getting barraged, but a couple of quick questions, apples or oranges?
Apples, definitely.
Can you put peanut butter on an apple? Is that why?
I mean, I also like peanut butter on an apple, but I just like apples more. I don't know.
Window or aisle?
Oh, window, 100%. I'm very much the, despite however many flights I've gotten to do now in the last year and a half, literally every single time we take off, I'm still like the kid who's like, oh my gosh, the cars, they look like ants. Like I just, the idea of flying is still so cool. So I want to look out that window the whole time.
Cool. All right. Favorite smell?
Favorite smell? I feel like it would be a food, but I don't know, like a campfire. I like a campfire smell.
Mm, yeah, it's good. Yeah, burning wood. Yeah, it's good. Star Trek, Star Wars, Doctor Who, Babylon 5?
Star Wars. I like movies, right? Yeah. So Star Wars right now is not thrilled. I like big, heavy visual effects, chaotic, creative energy movies, which is not where Star Wars is now, but that's where I liked all the prequels too. Like fit that bill. Right. Star Wars. Totally. Well,
I saw Star Wars when I was in high school and I was 17 when it first came out. And, I remember waiting like 21 years for Phantom Menace to come out. So yeah, I was there on day one on the first showing of that movie. So even though
I was, when did it come out? 99 or 98
around there, 98, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. I was 8 or 9 years old. So I was in the target demo that George Lucas was going for. I definitely loved it.
Huh. Cool. Got a couple more questions here. Do you have a dream you can remember?
A dream I can remember?
Yeah.
I mean, yes, I remember dreams, but any that like really stand out. I used to be like scared a lot of tornadoes. We get a lot of tornadoes here in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And so I remember having dreams of tornadoes that I would be scared of. I mean, I guess they were nightmares, but it wasn't like wake up in a cold sweat. It was just a thing I remember having lots of dreams about. And then in the moment, but the thing with dreams is I feel like I remember them. Often I'll tell somebody about them, but then by the end of the day, they kind of fade off somehow. Mm. It's kind of weird.
So what's the most used app on your phone?
Ooh, I mean, I guess I can like answer this objectively. Let's see. It's weird because it's like Overcast might be just because of podcasting, raw number of hours, right? Yeah. But is that really the intent of this? Or is it screen time? But then it's like, let's see what screen time says. Well, okay, this is kind of not true.
I was going to say
true,
Slack and Discord, last, if you're...
Well, in the last week, it's been Kindle, but that's... That's giving me more credit than I deserve. Because I, when I get into a book, like I'm an obsessive, phasey person. And so I will overly read it and go through it very quickly. And then I won't read another book for, you know, multiple months. So that's a little bit of a lie. And then it's messages. And then X, it looks like, Twitter. And then NetNewsWire and Slack, Threads. Google Maps has gotten a lot. Because, you know, when you're traveling, I guess. Overcast is really low. But I guess that's because it's reading, like... time it's on your screen, you know what I mean, which is not really necessarily accurate. So yeah, there you go.
Cool. All right, well, I guess the last question is a couple. Can you describe the rest of your life in five words?
Eating, drinking, peeing, pooping, talking. Oh, sleeping. We'll combine peeing and pooping.
Yeah, defecating, yeah, sure. Or voiding, we'll say voiding, because, you know, get them
voiding. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. All right. So, I guess we'll wrap up. So, people want to get in touch with you. Where would they find you online, or, and where will they see you in real life? And what are you doing these days?
I'm everywhere, everything, everywhere, all at once is kind of the idea. CharlieMChapman.com is my website. I think CharlieMChapman.me is my, like, that has all the points to, it points to whatever all the social medias are at any given point. I'm on all of them because I like people, and so I want to be where all the people are. So I just post everywhere and respond wherever people respond to me. And then in person, I'll be at Deep Dish Swift in Chicago here in a couple weeks. I don't know when this episode's coming out, but I believe there are still a couple tickets left. So maybe if you're listening to this, you can still snag one, and it is deeply worth going to because that conference is amazing. And then I'll be... If you're in Madrid, I'll be there briefly, looking for somebody to hang out with for like a night. So, you know, let me know if you're there, but there's not a conference. And then I'll be in Cupertino, for Dub Dub Week, that whole time doing all of the things, whatever I can find, to do there. I'll be there all week.
Sure. Do you have a ticket for the big keynote?
No, I don't.
Just hanging out?
Don't have the golden ticket, but I didn't have one last year. It's the golden ticket is sweet for that day, but like that day is just part of what makes it worth going there. There's so much stuff around it now, already, that it's incredibly worth going to, I think, still. So.
Well, that's a good question. I kind of wondered about that because, I remember when we used to have the in-person things, there were a lot of events at night and, you know, Pinterest or Big Nerd Ranch or something would have some, I know Revenue Cat's got something going on, but, and there's probably the indie dev people that used to do the San Francisco conference. So you're saying that just being in the area, there are like events to go to if you're a developer kind of thing?
Yeah. So there's a Discord. We started up the first year we had it, and it's grown every year. And the thing about it is it's more work because there isn't like one central place. But if you just say, especially if you're in like the San Jose area or Cupertino, if you're just like, hey, I'm going to go have coffee at blah, blah, a group of five people will just join you. And they're all into iOS stuff and whatever. And then there are events, especially the first, you know, Sunday, there's actually the core coffee they have meetups all the days, I think, except for Monday during the keynote, obviously. And then there's Revenue Cat. We officially did announce ours, although it sold out in like less than 12 hours, I think. But we have a big bash on Sunday night. The last few years, I don't think they've announced anything technically, but the last few years they've done an iOS dev happy hour thing that's usually on like Tuesday or Wednesday night. John Gruber has his talk show, which brings in a big crowd of people. John Dempsey does his Breakpoints conference thing. So there's enough things going on in the evenings that bring everybody together. And then during the days, a lot of people just hang out at the Apple Park Visitor Center or just say they're going to meet up for coffee or whatever. And then I've ended up just being with people the whole time I'm there. But you do kind of have to be a little more intentional. It's not as you just show up. Oh, and this year there's a side conference. It's not AltConf.
Yeah, one more thing. Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of connected to AltConf in some way. So I don't really know all the details on that. But there's something going on through the entire week also. So there's a lot going on. And hopefully every year it just keeps kind of growing until maybe it becomes... I think each year it's clear to people that this is worth coming to, even if you don't get a ticket. And as long as that keeps happening, it can get bigger and be worth, you know, the podcasters doing live shows and the Big Nerd Ranch doing parties and, you know, that kind of, those kind of events happening again. But it's getting there.
So do you have a link to the Discord you were talking about?
Yes.
You need to drop it to me. I'll put it in the show notes for people.
Yeah. If I forget to send it to you after this, please ask me and I'll make sure that you get it.
I will, yeah. All right. Well, my name is Timitra, T-I-M-M-I-T-R-A, on all the things, Twitter, Instagram. That's it for another go, and I'll see you in Chicago.
All right. See you in Chicago. Yeah, thanks.
Bye.
This has been another episode of the More Than Just Code podcast. If you want to find out more about the show, you can visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fm. There you can find a summary and show notes of each episode. We list links to the apps, code, and news that we mentioned on the show. If you like the podcast, tell your friends. Please leave a comment on the website, and if you can, please write a review on iTunes. And please recommend us in your favorite podcatcher. All of these things help others find out about the show. We really appreciate your help with spreading the word. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'd love to hear from you, so use the hashtag AskMTJC. Once again, the podcast Twitter account is at MTJC_podcast. Please consider supporting the show by pledging any amount on patreon.com/MTJC. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.